From New York, this is Democracy Now!
America has given us an unprecedented and powerful mandate. We have taken back control of the Senate. Wow, that's good.
Donald Trump is headed back to the White House 4 years after attempting a coup to stay in power. In a resounding victory over Vice President Kamala Harris, Trump is projected to have secured at least 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the presidency. It appears he may also win the popular vote, which he lost twice before. Republicans have also regained control of the Senate. But the House is still up for grabs. We'll spend the hour examining results and looking at what 4 more years of a Trump presidency means for the country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Donald Trump is headed back to the White House after defeating Vice President Kamala Harris following a campaign where he vowed to retaliate against his critics and to carry out the largest mass deportation of immigrants in U.S. history. As of this broadcast, Trump had secured at least 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the presidency. Harris has 224 electoral votes. The race was called for Trump after he won the critical swing states of Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Trump is also leading in Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona. Donald Trump is the first convicted felon and, at 78 years, the oldest candidate ever elected president. He appears on pace to win the popular vote for the first time after receiving fewer votes than Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Joe Biden in 2020. Trump spoke at his Mar-a-Lago resort early Wednesday morning and said he'd won a, quote, unprecedented and powerful mandate.
Many people have told me that God spared my life for a reason. And that reason was to save our country and to restore America to greatness.
Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, described Trump's victory as the, quote, greatest political comeback in the history of the United States, unquote. People who attended Trump's victory party included tech billionaire Elon Musk, who spent at least $119 million to help get Trump elected. Trump is poised to join Grover Cleveland as the only former president to lose re-election and then return to the White House 4 years later. Trump won despite warnings from many of his former cabinet members that he was unfit for office, in part for attempting to overturn the 2020 election. On election night, Kamala Harris did not address supporters who'd gathered for a watch party at her alma mater, Howard University, the historically black university. She's expected to address the nation today. The Republican Party has clinched control of the United States Senate, shifting the balance of power on Capitol Hill. In West Virginia, Governor Jim Justice won the race to fill the seat vacated by Senator Joe Manchin, who earlier this year quit the Democratic Party and said he would not seek re-election. Justice is a wealthy heir to a coal mining fortune with a net worth estimated at over $500 million. In 2022, Justice signed a near total ban on abortion in West Virginia. He also spoke at the Republican National Convention. In Montana, Republican Tim Sheehy is projected to have beaten the incumbent Democrat, Senator John Tester, flipping another Senate seat for Republicans. In Ohio, Republican Bernie Moreno has defeated Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown, who's held the seat since 2007. Before then, Brown served in the House of Representatives, where he opposed the Iraq War, the USA Patriot Act, and became an early champion of marriage equality. Senator Brown conceded defeat late Tuesday.
We believe in the power of people over corporate special interests. We always will.
We believe if you love this country, you fight for the people who make it work. We always will. This is a disappointment, but is not a failure.
Senator-elect Bernie Moreno is a multimillionaire luxury car dealer and cryptocurrency entrepreneur who benefited from $40 million in campaign cash from crypto firms. Ohio's Senate race was the most expensive Senate race in U.S. history. Some estimates put total spending at around $500 million. In Nebraska, Republican Senator Deb Fischer held off a challenge from independent Dan Osborne, and the Republicans could win several more Senate races. In Pennsylvania, Dave McCormick has a one-point lead over Senator Bob Casey. In Nevada, Republican Sam Brown has a slight lead over Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen. In Michigan, Republican Mike Rogers is ahead of Alyssa Slotkin. In Wisconsin, incumbent Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin declared victory after it appeared her narrow lead over multimillionaire banker Eric Hovda will hold. In Arizona, Democrat Ruben Gallego has a lead over Republican challenger Carrie Lake, a far-right election denier and Trump ally. The two are vying for Kyrsten Sinema's seat after the Democrat-turned-independent announced she was not seeking re-election. In other Senate news, for the first time in history, two black women will serve in the Senate at the same time. Angela Alsobrooks in Maryland and Lisa Blunt Rochester in Delaware, both Democrats. It remains unclear which party will control the House of Representatives, but Democrats did pick up a pair of seats in New York State. Republican Tom Barrett, meanwhile, flipped a seat in Michigan previously held by Democratic Congressmember Alyssa Slotkin. In Delaware, Democrat Sarah McBride has been elected the first openly transgender congressmember in U.S. history, defeating Republican John Whelan. She's vowed to address criminal justice reform, abortion rights, and gun violence. Meanwhile, historic ballot measures enshrining the right to an abortion passed in seven states: Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Montana, Maryland, New York, and Missouri, where voters backed a measure that will overturn one of the strictest abortion bans in the country that prohibits the procedure even in cases of rape and incest. Missouri was the first state to enact an abortion ban after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. In Arizona, voters approved Prop 139 by a landslide, establishing a fundamental right to abortion and prohibiting state officials from restricting or banning the procedure before 24 weeks of pregnancy. Similar ballot proposals failed in three states, in South Dakota, Nebraska, and Florida, where a measure that would have rolled back the state's six-week abortion ban garnered over 57% of the vote, just short of the 60% supermajority needed to pass. In international news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired his defense minister Yoav Gallant Tuesday in a surprise move that triggered large-scale protests across Israel. Gallant had publicly disagreed with Netanyahu over a temporary deal to exchange Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. He also insisted Israel carry out a full investigation into the failures that led to Hamas's October 7th attack, something Netanyahu rejected. Netanyahu appointed Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz to succeed Gallant. Katz recently led a successful campaign to cancel Israel's agreements with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA. Earlier this year, he proposed creating an artificial island off Gaza's coast where Palestinians could be forcibly relocated. In August, Israel Katz called for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, declaring, quote, "This is a war on all fronts, and we must win it," he said. On Tuesday, protests erupted in Jerusalem near Netanyahu's official residence, calling for the prime minister to resign. Meanwhile, tens of thousands marched in Tel Aviv, where protesters blocked a major highway.
We believe it has never, ever been this urgent. We believe the worst threat on the very existence of the state of Israel is not posed by Iran or Hezbollah or Hamas, but by our own government. Our own government is doing whatever is within its power to destroy us from within.
In the Gaza Strip, four Palestinians were killed when Israeli troops shelled a home southeast of Khan Yunis. Elsewhere, an Israeli airstrike leveled an apartment building in Gaza City, killing five people. On Tuesday, Palestinians in Gaza observed the U.S. election with a mix of dread and resignation. This is Ikram Aham, a Khan Yunis resident who spoke to reporters surrounded by the rubble of her home, which was destroyed by Israeli attacks.
Here's our destruction. The destruction of the Gaza Strip is at the hands of the Americans. All the explosive materials that America sends to Gaza only bring destruction. What can we benefit from America? What will we gain from it, from the U.S. elections? Did the U.S. president encourage us in any way? No. He stood against us, against our kids in the Gaza Strip, and against our very lives. He destroyed us and the Gaza Strip.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have killed at least eight Palestinians in a series of raids that began Monday. Two people were killed in the town of Tamun, where Israeli troops were seen moving a body with an armored bulldozer. Elsewhere, at least four people were killed in the city of Kabatia near Jenin. During the raid, photojournalist Rabi Al-Munir was shot in the abdomen and rushed to a hospital where he's in stable condition. Palestinian medics said a three-year-old child was also hospitalized after being bitten by an Israeli attack dog. Israel's military is continuing its assault on towns and villages in southern Lebanon, where on Tuesday at least 20 people were killed and more than a dozen others wounded when an Israeli airstrike tore through a high-rise apartment building in the coastal town of Barja, south of Beirut. The attack came without warning. Resident Musa Zahran showed reporters the twisted wreckage of his home after he narrowly survived the attack, which left his young son and wife hospitalized when their home collapsed around them.
We were drinking coffee in the living room. These slabs that you see here weigh 100 kilograms. They fell on a 13-kilogram child, and all of these fell on my wife.
Today, a group of 12 NGOs, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, called on the United Nations Human Rights Council to investigate abuses committed during Israel's war in Lebanon, which has killed over 3,000 people. Jeremy Smith of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies said in a statement, quote, "There's a huge risk of the same types of atrocities occurring in Lebanon as in Gaza." In the UK, police arrested Israeli filmmaker, activist and retired academic Chaim Breshith under the British Terrorism Act, after he gave a speech on Friday advocating for Palestinian rights during a protest. Breshith is a child of Holocaust survivors and founder of the Jewish Network for Palestine. Police accused him of, quote, making hate speech, but refused to answer questions from Breshith and his supporters when pressed over what specifically triggered the arrest. He was released without charge the next day. It's the latest in a series of arrests in Britain under the Terrorism Act targeting people who voice criticism of Israel. At least three journalists have been detained and are raided over their reporting. And a judge in New York has ordered Rudy Giuliani to appear in court tomorrow after he emptied out most of his possessions from his Manhattan apartment before two election workers who won a defamation case against him were able to collect on their $148 million judgment. A judge last year found Giuliani defamed Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, a mother and daughter, when he falsely accused them of committing election fraud in Georgia in 2020. On Tuesday, Giuliani showed up to vote in Palm Beach, Florida, driving up in a Mercedes he'd been ordered to surrender. It formerly belonged to Lauren Bacall. It was the same polling place where Trump cast his ballot. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Coming up, we discuss Donald Trump's victory over Kamala Harris. Stay with us.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours unhurt. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Jump,
get up, stand up,
jump, jump.
Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley and the Wailers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Donald Trump is headed back to the White House 4 years after attempting a coup to stay in power. In a resounding victory over Vice President Kamala Harris, Trump is projected to have secured at least 277 electoral votes, surpassing the 270 needed to win the presidency. It appears he may also win the popular vote, which he lost twice before. Republicans have also regained control of the Senate, but the House is still up for grabs. The presidential race was called for Trump after he won the critical swing states of Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Trump's also in the lead in Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona as we broadcast. Trump's the first convicted felon and at 78, the oldest candidate ever elected president. He appears on pace to win the popular vote for the first time after receiving fewer votes than Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Joe Biden in 2020. We begin with two guests. Michelle Goodwin is professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University and founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. And in Atlanta, Georgia, we're joined by Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University, author of many books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Her other books include The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America, and White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We welcome you back, both, to Democracy Now! After our four-hour special last night. Professor Anderson, let's begin with you. If you can respond to Trump's victory.
The Confederacy won. When you begin to really think about what he advocated, the kind of racism, the kind of xenophobia, the kind of hatred, all wrapped in a sense of honor and gallantry, and how that resonated with such a large, wide swath of the American public, that begins to tell you that you're seeing the backlash to what they call the great, you know, you're seeing the backlash to what they fear was the great replacement. And so this is feels like the kind of last stand of white supremacy, and it's going to put so many of us in jeopardy. And it's also part of the drug of American exceptionalism, where those who voted for him believe that they're going to be safe from the policies that he's going to rain down. And so that becomes part of the amnesia of not seeing how he handled COVID, not remembering how he handled COVID, of not remembering his tariff wars that basically almost bankrupted farmers in Iowa. And the kind of chaos that he brings, the kind of divisiveness that he brings. It's like living in a reality show and believing that it's not reality. This is a dark day for America. I think of Thomas Jefferson when he said, "I tremble for my country because God is just," because that's what we're looking at. I'm trembling for our country right now.
And Professor Anderson, the vote that Trump got, right now it's at 71 million, it'll probably go up 1 or 2 million more as other states are counted in and absentee ballots. But it's still roughly about the vote that he got certainly last time. But the big drop appears to be in the vote for Kamala Harris. She's at the national vote is 66 million now, significantly below the 81 million that Joe Biden got. Why do you think there's been such a disparity in her vote totals this time around?
I think part of what we're looking at, because she was explicit about policies, and so the language that she just needs to explain her policies is hokum. It's that... we're looking at the misogyny and the racism and the fear of what it meant to have a Black Asian woman who's married to a Jewish man sitting in the White House, that this was not the kind of vision of America that large swath that voted for Trump believe is America. It is the fear of what a multicultural, multiracial, multilingual, diverse America could mean. It means, and so you're seeing the backlash to her very being. It's a sad day for America. It's a sad day because there was a really explicit about the horrors of Project 2025 and what that meant for Social Security, what that meant for Medicare, what that meant for education, what that meant for equity. All of that could not override the depth of the misogyny, the depth of the racism that that fuels the MAGA movement, that fuels Trump.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Michelle Goodwin into the conversation from Georgetown University. Professor, your reaction to the results?
We have to understand this as a Project 2024. So the response, which I think was so eloquently put just now, is an amalgamation of a number of things. If we look at what the election results were based on race, it paints a picture. In the United States, it paints a picture with regard to how people think about electing a woman, how people think about electing a woman who is Black and of Asian descent. It paints a picture policy-wide about what Americans are willing to embrace. And in that way, it's a Project 2024. It's a Project 1619 in terms of what Americans are willing to accept. To the extent that we know that Donald Trump is willing to fulfill on what it is that he says, he said that he wanted to criminally punish women. He said in 2016, 2015, he said that he wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. After that occurred, he took full credit for that. There were a number of things that he had hoped to dismantle. This was a president who, right after coming into office, had a Muslim ban. Was responsible for kids at the border being placed in cages, being fed frozen burritos. This was an administration that had its lawyers fighting to deny those children soap and toothpaste, arguing before federal judges that those children who were locked in cages in federal custody did not deserve soap, did not deserve toothpaste. This was a president who failed on COVID, who made sure that he had medications for himself, vaccine, and then also sent to others, including what has been alleged to Russia and to Putin, so that there would be access to the best of what we had for COVID at that time. But for Americans, did not do a good job at all in terms of collaboration, cooperation, and leading with regard to COVID, and instead had suggested that perhaps injections of bleach and other things might be the way to respond to COVID. And one could really go down the list in terms of what that presidency represented, and Americans overwhelmingly voted for that. But is that something that is new? I think that one of our challenges in our country is to really understand the arc of who we've been and the arc of who we are. We tend to think that we actually had our own truth and reconciliation such that we have confronted what have been the thorny, horrific parts of our past. And we haven't. We've done the work of a South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Germany, right? We've not looked and said, how can we tolerate systems where women were denied citizenship? How could we tolerate women being denied the right to vote? How could we tolerate women being denied the opportunity to become lawyers? And I'm talking about Supreme Court cases. How could we tolerate women being denied from serving on juries? How could we tolerate women being denied the opportunity to have bank accounts in their own names, have their own checking accounts in their own names? And that's a modern iteration. And then we could unpack what this means in terms of Jim Crow and slavery. How could we be a nation that tolerated children standing on auction blocks and being auctioned off, bid upon, not for a horrific day where we wake up and say, my goodness, what was that all about? Bidding on children in shackles and chains. No, but not a practice that lasted a day, a week, a year. A year alone might have been waking up and saying, how in the world could we have tolerated that? But to see that flow into centuries and then to create patterns of justification and narratives for that, that then flowed into Jim Crow, a time in the United States that was marked very narrowly by what happened to Rosa Parks, but more fulsomely, the denial of people being able to walk into parks, swim in pools, go into motels, stay at hotels, live where they wanted to based on their race. And a practice that lasted for generations upon generations that then required federal intervention. So we have to ask ourselves, how could we have tolerated all of that? And in part, the answer is what we see in the election yesterday, is that we're willing to tolerate more of that. And then we have to ask ourselves, why? What is behind that?
Professor Goodwin, you're a professor of global health. You mentioned Trump's policies during COVID, and now he said he's talking about putting Robert Kennedy, the presidential candidate, in charge of women's health. But also Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said that he expected to be in charge of what did he talk about? The CDC, the National Institutes of Health, a well-known vaccine denier. The significance of all of this, because it's beyond Trump. It's who will be in his government, from Elon Musk to RFK Jr.
That is a perfect question. And in 2015, 2016, I wrote an article about this, that while we could pay attention to, and it was right to, in terms of who would be elected president, what we needed to think about is who that individual would appoint to lead governmental agencies, because that's critically important. It relates to our clean air, the water that we drink, the education that children will be provided, and so much more. To place in context the Trump administration and COVID is to realize the following. There were more Americans that died in the first 3 months of COVID under his leadership than in 19 years of the Vietnam War, the Korean War, and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I know your listeners and viewers might be stunned by that and wonder, does Professor Goodwin have that right? Well, I have testified before Congress with regard to that. I have looked at the numbers. I have run the numbers. I've written about this. Yes, more Americans died in our first 3 months of COVID under Donald Trump's leadership than all of the Americans that died in the Vietnam War and these other wars that I mentioned. And so the risks with regard to Americans' health happens to be high. And again, it's a Project 2024 that we're looping out into a Project 2025. And I want to be clear about that, because it's not hyperbole. It is to really understand that there has been a struggle in our country towards recognizing that all Americans deserve to be healthy, deserve to be able to have access to healthcare. We are not like our peer nations, and ones that the former president would not call our peer nations, where there is universal healthcare, where there are doctors that even will come to your home, or where you can be treated easily. I know that they talk about in those other countries, and you'll wait a long time, all of that. Americans have to pay a high price for their health care. And fortunately, there's the Affordable Care Act. But note that under his administration, and there were attempts to still do away with the Affordable Care Act. So what will all of this mean in terms of the people that he will appoint? I would say, let's not just look at what this means in terms of health. We have to look at this in terms of the EPA. We have to look at this in terms of other agencies that serve the American public. And I think that people should be quite concerned. And one other thing that I will add to that, Amy, is that it is very likely that there will continue to be global epidemics, pandemics. COVID was the first of its kind in 100 years, was the second. We, 100 years before, had experienced something like that. But these may happen with greater frequency. People move far more today. We have more planes that are taking people from one part of the world to the other part of the world. And so it actually is really important in terms of thinking about global public health that we pay attention to who is governing in these spaces in the United States and elsewhere.
And very quickly, Professor Goodwin, the historic ballot measures enshrining the right to an abortion passed in 7 of the 10 states that they were introduced, passed in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, Montana, Maryland, New York, and Missouri, where voters backed a measure that'll overturn one of the strictest abortion bans in the nation that prohibits abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. The significance of that, and yet, at the same time, Kamala Harris loses.
Well, again, if we parse this out, what we can see is that white women overwhelmingly voted for the former president, but yet also voted for the constitutional protection or statewide protections of abortion rights in their state. So they were able to parse these issues out, even though Donald Trump is, you know, articulated wanting to criminally punish women and wanting to and has appointed federal judges and justices on the lower courts as well as the Supreme Court in order to make it very difficult to access reproductive health care, yet they could parse their vote. And it's not just them, it's men too. And I want to make one clarification too. In Florida, it's being articulated that women in Florida rejected the ballot initiative there. No, overwhelmingly, the majority of people in that state voted for that initiative, except it was required that there be at least 60%. And what we know is that it's been over 57, 58% that voted for the initiative. So it failed by a small percentage, but it's worth noting that that was a requirement that meant more than a majority had to vote in support of that initiative.
I want to thank you both for being with us. There's so much more to talk about. And we've also extended this broadcast to 2 hours for those stations who are taking it. We have been speaking with Michelle Goodwin, who is a professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. And we want to thank Professor Carol Anderson, professor of African American Studies at Emory University, speaking to us from Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta, Georgia, that President Trump has won the state of Georgia. We thank you both for being with us. When we come back, Ralph Nader.
Come on down. Well, welcome to the Terror Dome. Power cannot run and hide, but it shouldn't be suicide. In a game, a fool without the rules. Got a hell of a nerve to just criticize. Every brother ain't a brother, cause a black hand squeezed a Malcolm X man. The shooting of Huey Newton from a hand, pull the trigger. Destroy yourself first, nothing worse than the mother's pain of a son slain in prison. Her can't wait for the state to side the fate. So this jam I dedicate places with the racist faces. Example one of many places. Weak, weak in speech, I speak from a lesson learned in Virginia. I don't smile in a line of fire, go wild and butter from bass and drums, even violence. What you do? Get your head ready instead of getting physically sweaty. When I get mad, I put it down on a pad.
Welcome to the Terror Dome by Public Enemy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at Donald Trump's victory over Kamala Harris and the Republicans taking control of the Senate, we don't know yet about the House. We're joined by Ralph Nader, the longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time presidential candidate, author of many books, including most recently, Let's Start the Revolution, Tools for Displacing the Corporate State and Building a Country That Works for the People. Ralph Nader is the founder of the monthly newspaper, The Capitol Hill Citizen. Ralph, thanks so much for joining us. Your response to Donald Trump's victory. It looks like he not only won the Electoral College, but will win the popular vote this time, as he didn't in the two past elections.
Well, I mean, Juan, there's going to be a lot to digest here. This is a collapse of the Democratic Party. They didn't get their vote out that they wanted. They were several million votes below what they expected, and of course that made the difference in an electoral college system in the swing states. But the problem is much more serious than that. Basically, we now are a country under a dictatorial corporate state. Trump is basically a magnet and a trap for the Democrats. They spent tens of millions of dollars on ads going after Trump instead of going after the 4 years that Trump deep-sixed so many critical issues and positions in his term as president. So the problem is it's so many variables here to deal with. It all started, Amy, when the Democrats abandoned half the country to the red states. That's devastating. Then they started getting corporate cash in 1979, dialing for the same commercial values. That blurred their difference from the New Deal-type Democrats to the corporate Democrats. Then they contracted out the election to these corporate-conflicted profiteering consulting firms, which the mass media never seemed to want to investigate in this campaign. And then they abandoned public media. Basically, they abandoned radio to the Rush Limbaughs and created the Reagan Democrats. And then they never learned from their mistakes. They didn't learn from the mistakes of Hillary Clinton in 2016. Then they never fire anybody after they lose in one state after another to horrendous, the worst Republican Party in history. And so what is the message that they gave to the American people? The message is Trump is terrible, and you can't believe how bad the Republican Party is. It's too general a message, just simple. A vast majority of people think corporations have too much control over their lives. They didn't fill the blanks, denial of health care benefits. And they didn't fill the blanks on a living wage. They didn't fill the blanks on cracking down on corporate crooks. They didn't fill the blanks on reversing a tax system which undertaxes the very wealthy and the big corporations. They didn't reverse themselves really on trade. They didn't know how to rebut Trump on immigration. And we called the people coming in rapists, criminals, drug traffickers, etc. Instead of saying, well, they're fleeing oppressive countries that are backed by the U.S. dictators and oligarchs in Central and South America. They didn't say that millions of Americans trust immigrants to harvest their food, to care for their children, to care for elderly, to provide critical services that nobody wants to work in the U.S. So there's such a bill of particulars against this Democratic Party, and what's happened, of course, is that millions of people are basically saying we're sick of throwaway lines. We're sick of not having the government return the benefits of massive taxation to us. We're sick of all we hear about is empire abroad. All we hear about is more military budgets by the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress, giving the generals more than they asked for, eating the public budgets that should be providing public services and public infrastructure in communities all over the country, creating key jobs. Now, we tried to straighten out these Democrats. 24 civic leaders in 2022, going into the present time, tried to tell them how to communicate, what to communicate with all the people, and they didn't listen. The Democratic Party severed any kind of response That's Nancy Pelosi. That's Chuck Schumer. You name them. With the civic community in Washington, D.C. The ones that...
Well, Ralph... Ralph, let me ask you, for the progressive movement now as it faces the return of Donald Trump, what do you think are the next steps in terms of resistance or reorganization that have to occur?
Well, it's got to be focused on Congress. The House is not yet resolved, but only Congress can stop the Trumpsters. It isn't just Trump. Trump is a figurehead. Trump is a bullhorn. It's the Trumpsters. It's the Heritage Foundation. It's 2025. It's the takeover of departments that are dedicated to standing up for the people. The Environmental Protection Bureau, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Auto Safety Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission, the Justice Department. These are all going to be turned into virulent, vengeful, or inactive governments. They want to destroy the civil service, bring it back to the spoiled system. We're in for huge turmoil. One can say that the election yesterday really elected President Vance. Trump's not going to last. He's going to disintegrate. And Vance is in a position to become the next president. So what has to be done, one, is massive focus on Congress, which is the main constitutionally authorized lever to hold the executive branch accountable. Build for 2026. The Democrats will have far fewer people up for the Senate than the Republicans, unlike this year. And they've got to stop blasting away at people who want to challenge the Democratic Party. The party says to everybody on their side, you know how bad the Republicans are? You got nowhere to go. They spent a lot of money attacking the Green Party, the tiny Green Party, instead of listening to William Barber, Reverend William Barber, who said, look, there's 80 million people who aren't going to vote. A lot of them are low-wage workers. If you get 15% of low-wage workers who aren't voting to go to the polls, the Democrats would have won. They didn't listen to them. They didn't listen to all the citizen groups who know how to talk to people, not just liberal patients or liberal workers, but conservative workers, conservative patients. Remember, a vast majority of this country wants to tax the undertaxed wealthy in the corporation. They want to break up the big banks. And above all, in poll after poll, they say that corporations have too much control over their lives. Sherrod Brown pulled in his horns and lost. Bernie Sanders campaigned on corporate power, and he won in a landslide in Vermont. And Harris refused to campaign with Bernie Sanders, but she campaigned in several states with Liz Cheney of the criminal Cheney family and the invasion of Iraq that killed over a million Iraqis. So the blunders were endless. It was basically turning their back on the progressive, the genuine populist constituency in this country. And Bernie, of course, supported Harris, but his positions were rejected constantly. He said, get the living wage up, get universal health care up, crack down on corporate crooks, increase Social Security benefits that have been frozen for over 50 years, and get the taxation on the wealthy. She ignored all that. Just throwaway lines.
Ralph Nader, we're also joined in Madison, Wisconsin, by John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, author of more than a dozen books, including his latest, co-written with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who just won re-election last night. The book is called It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. You've just listened to Ralph Nader talking about the problems with the Democratic position that was represented by Kamala Harris. If you can talk about how this played out in the Senate races, because you're in Wisconsin, which Trump won, but it looks like Tammy Baldwin has eked out a victory to retain her Senate seat. And then in Ohio, Bernie Moreno, the luxury car dealer, cryptocurrency millionaire, beat out Sherrod Brown, who opposed the Iraq War, opposed the USA Patriot Act, an angry and early champion of marriage equality and labor activist. John Nichols, take us through these Senate races and then what it means, the positions that Kamala Harris took. In a sense, not exactly shunning Bernie Sanders, but as Ralph said, not campaigning with her, with him.
Well, I think Ralph Nader's points are very accurate. And in fact, I was actually taking notes as I was listening here. I would also say one other thing. Ralph was talking about this throughout the campaign, and inspired by him, I wrote a number of articles on getting the issue of trade into this campaign at the presidential level, and it just didn't happen. And there's a host of other issues that didn't as well. And that you can see writ large in the Senate and the House races. You're not going to get a pure read one way or the other, but you can get real indications. As Ralph Nader said, Bernie Sanders won by a landslide in Vermont. And he did that while actually spending a good deal of his time out on the campaign trail in other states, raising so many of the points that Ralph Nader just raised. And also a host of others on these issues. Tammy Baldwin won in Wisconsin, and I think that's a race that really is going to be worthy of dissection, because Tammy Baldwin was one of the few candidates running for the Senate on the Democratic side that consistently ran ads that featured workers and union members, multiracial, multiethnic, talking about their challenges, pensions being taken away, bad trade policies, all of these things that we're discussing here today. And so though she won very, very narrowly, Tammy Baldwin's victory is actually a real example of what you can do, because she ran, and we'll get the exact figures, it looks like she ran about 60,000 votes ahead of the top of the ticket in Wisconsin. That was obviously deciding. Let me give you a few more details on where we're at. One of the things that Ralph Nader just said that's really important is that Congress is essential in all of these equations. We have to look at the Congress as a potential, not a certain, but a potential place of opposition and an actual ability to stop some of the things that Donald Trump would want to do as president. In the Senate races right now, it is absolutely clear the Republicans have won the Senate. They're going to have a majority of at least 52-48, and I fear that will probably expand a little bit. There are still technically six uncalled races. I think about four of them could go to the Democrats, two of them a little shakier. If that majority there in the Senate is a big deal, because if it's a 52-48, you still have some ability to move a couple of the Republican senators who were not supportive of Trump over into a coalition to at least stop some things. If the majority expands for the Republicans, that's going to be a lot harder. But one of the things that we have to focus on right away is organizing in the states where there are Republican senators who could be moved or who might be moved on particular issues. That actually happened during Trump's first term on some education issues where activists, teachers union activists in places like Alaska got Lisa Murkowski to move on particular issues, very vital votes. Now let's flip over to the House of Representatives, because the House of Representatives is, if it has a Democratic majority, and that is not assured, but if it gets a Democratic majority, it will become the base of opposition to Trump's presidency. There should not be let's see if we can find places to work together. There should be a clear signal that, look, this House of Representatives is going to do everything in its power to stop bad initiatives. They have a lot of budget power. They have a lot of power on approving all sorts of bills on all sorts of issues. They have to have a united caucus. What's critical in the House is the number of seats that are still up for grabs. I looked just before we came on air. There are 54 seats up for grabs. Most of them are on the West Coast in California, Washington, and Oregon, very Democratic states. But there are also some out in the Midwest and a number even on the East Coast. Once we get a read on where the House is, I think that the likelihood is that it will not be a large Democratic majority if the Democrats win it. And again, I emphasize they may not win it. But if they do win it, it won't be a large majority. But if it is, you know, if it's even three or four seats, that's enough space if Speaker Hakeem Jeffries and other people recognize their critical role as a check and balance on the administration.
If, in fact, the House goes Democrat. But, John, we're going to have time to also talk about this in the second hour. But I also wanted to address the issue of foreign policy from Dearborn, Michigan. To talk about Donald Trump's election, we want to go to Michigan, where we're joined by Linda Sarsour, a Palestinian-American Muslim organizer, author of We're Not Here to Be Bystanders, co-founder of Empower Action Fund. Yes, Dearborn, the Arab of a majority city. Trump won 42% of the vote over Vice President Kamala Harris, who received 36%. Jill Stein received 18%. Stein campaigned calling for an arms embargo against Israel. And I also want to hear what Ralph Nader has to say about this. Linda Sarsour, if you can respond, we spoke to you last night. Now a lot of the results are in. If you can comment on what happened and what a Trump presidency will mean for Israel-Palestine.
I appreciated hearing Ralph Nader's analysis, which I share. And this is all goes to the feet of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party literally marginalized Arab American, Palestinian, and Muslim American voters. Kamala Harris did not really, in my opinion, make any effort to really win over the votes of these demographics. Kamala Harris continued to parrot the usual talking points about humanitarian aid and about what's happening in Gaza being devastated without any action plan. She was asked many times, would you break from the policies of Joe Biden or in the ways in which Joe Biden has addressed the genocide in Gaza? And she has said no multiple times. Again, Donald Trump engaged in outreach in the Muslim American community. He went and visited mosques. He met with religious leaders. He had billboards all across Dearborn that were multilingual in the language, in Arabic languages, in Bangla, in Urdu. And whether or not people agree with Donald Trump or whether or not, and you know me, Amy, I'm having deja vu of 2016. I was a frontline organizer when Donald Trump was president. So I'm not looking forward to the next 4 years. But the Trump campaign did the outreach. They filled in a gap that was left by the Democratic Party. And all Kamala Harris had to say in this election was, I will uphold international law. I will actually enforce the laws we already have on the books when it comes to military aid to any country violating human rights. But the campaign made a calculation. They made a calculation that they did not need Arab American, Muslim American, and Palestinian American voters, that they can actually win this election without this important electorate. They were too busy courting Liz Cheney and her friends instead of coming to Michigan and actually having deep, courageous conversations with the critics of the Kamala and Biden administration. So this is a devastating moment for our communities. Donald Trump is someone that we know very well. We don't only know him on domestic policy, we know him also on foreign policy. He gave sovereignty to Israel over the Golan Heights. He declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel. There is an Israeli settlement that is named after Donald Trump. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, believes that Gaza is this beautiful waterfront property. We are going to be in big trouble. And I blame that solely on the Democratic Party and one of the worst run campaigns that I've seen in my 23 years in organizing.
And Linda, I wanted to ask you something I asked earlier to some of our other guests. There was not a large outpouring of independent votes, but there definitely was a decline in the overall Democratic vote. Kamala Harris apparently gotten 15 million votes less than sleepy Joe Biden did in 2020. I'm wondering what your sense was, that those who stayed home are really a reflection of some of the failures of the Democrats this time around.
Absolutely. And the thing that people don't want to talk about, and as you know, the Democratic Party is not a fan of mine because they don't like to listen to critics who actually are organizers and know how to mobilize communities. Somebody should ask the Democratic Party, how much money did you invest in Black and Brown-led organizations who do get out the vote efforts, who engage and build power locally in communities? Somebody needs to ask them that question. They spent a majority of their money on ads, on television ads, and really ignored the grassroots. I was on the ground in Pitt County, North Carolina. I was in Saginaw, Michigan. I was in Dearborn. I went to Georgia, and I did not see the type of field operation that is worthy of our communities. And Joe Biden had the Democratic House, Senate, and White House in his first 2 years, and he couldn't deliver on things like protecting and expanding voting rights. He blamed Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema for being obstacles to his agenda. He couldn't even get two Democrats in line to pass legislation. Lots of women across the country care about things like reproductive rights. Why didn't the Joe Biden administration push Congress to codify Roe? We are in this situation because Democrats want to be in power, but they don't know how to use their power once they are in office. And that is a failure of the party. And the party has to go back to its roots if it wants to move from here. You are either going to be loyal to your base, which majority supported ceasefire and support arms embargo against Israel, that support progressive issues, or you're going to continue to try to recruit a constituency that does not exist, that did not turn out for you in this election. And I hope somebody in the campaign right now is sitting and reflecting on this, and hopefully some people are fired and no longer will be working for the party after this election.
Is Palestinian American. Ralph Nader, you are Lebanese American. We only have a minute, but your response on the issue of the Democratic position, the Biden-Harris position on Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon right now, and what you think has to happen. Because, in fact, the Democrats are in power right now before Trump takes over.
Well, you asking me?
I am.
Yeah. Well, Biden's projecting weakness. There are a lot of voters who want strength, and Trump understands that. And on the Middle East, he's projecting incredible weakness. That's why we call him Bibi Biden and his Secretary of State, Bibi Blinken. He's giving Netanyahu whatever he wants, daily shipments of deadly weapons of mass destruction, diplomatic cover, veto in the U.N., pushing allied countries to get in line. He even refuses to demand that Netanyahu let American reporters in to Gaza to report what's going on. He won't even allow airlifting at the request of American doctors who were over in Gaza, airlifting burned babies and amputee children for treatment in ready and able American hospitals. He is a co-combatant with the Palestinian Holocaust and the genocide that's going on, and Israel's making no bones of this. Netanyahu wants the whole of Palestine, the West Bank, southern Lebanon to the Litani River, and it's all go signal from Biden. So he's projecting weakness here. He is weakly representing the mighty United States of America as if he's an adjunct, a poodle. For the Netanyahu regime.
We have to leave it there. That does it for this hour. I want to thank Ralph Nader, Linda Sarsour, and John Nichols of The Nation. This is Democracy Now!, War, Peace, and the Presidency. Stay tuned for hour two of our expanded post-election show right here. Or if the station isn't running it, you can go to democracynow.org. And on this day, I want to wish a happy birthday to John Hamilton and Emily Anderson, and our deepest condolences to our producer, Messiah Rhodes, on the passing of his dad, David Rhodes. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.